And a very pleasant good morning to you. It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short, who's actually not here today, and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter Abell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Tracy Ellis, your host with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. If you have questions, you can email me, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. And Representatives Abell and Engel were busy this weekend with full days, Saturday a full day, and then here late Friday as well. What were some of the bills that you guys ended up voting on, and is there anything? Let's start on the bright side. Is there anything that passed off the House floor that you're excited about?
Well, let me start with because I'm excited. My first bill, the bill that we've talked about before about Group B water systems, passed out of the Senate, but the governor signed it on Friday, and so we had the bill signing. And that's exciting. That bill is now law.
Congratulations. Your first law. It goes from your first bill to your first law. It's like watching a newborn grow up and graduate from college.
Well, it was quite a process. I haven't had a chance yet to write the story of how that bill became a law, because it's a lot more complicated than the Schoolhouse Rock version.
It seems that way. Anything else that you're excited about?
Well, I'll chime in just briefly about the bill signing on Friday. It was a neat thing. Friday was a big day, actually, because we had a large number of school kids come in visit from the district, which was wonderful. And then also the pastor from my church, Incheon Community Church, came in and delivered the invocation on the floor on Friday morning. This was Pastor Annunzio. So we had all these folks from here in the district that happened to be here on the same day that we're getting your first bill passed.
Right.
I'm calling it our, but it's your first bill, Andrew's first bill passed. And so it came time to go to the signing ceremony at the governor's office. And it was one of those things, well, why don't you all, come along? And so you had quite the crowd there.
I did. And it was fun. It was the last one. And I was honestly feeling a little like, my family had to go home the day before, and so they weren't able to be there with me. And so I'm like, okay, it's just going to be me and the governor. And then Hunter said he could join. And so we're talking with this group, and I'm like, hey, have you ever have any interest in coming to a bill signing? I think it really made their day.
It was kind of funny. I was there basically to carry Andrew's briefcase. I think the governor was kind of like, why are you here? I'm like, I'm here to cheer him on. Like, this is big news for the district. So it was a neat day there on Friday.
You know, it's interesting because I wonder how many of them actually knew what Group B water systems are as they stood there in support of the bill.
They knew a little bit because I tried to explain it to them right before we went in, but they probably didn't really understand it.
You know, that's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about that bill. I mean, you know, this is something that happens in the legislature sometimes, and if it wasn't your bill, we would not be talking about it, frankly. But, you know, it is, for these Group B water systems, this was a pretty important bill.
It really was. And I think what's important is people in rural areas often have, you buy a piece of land and you want to build a home, and getting water is one of the most unpredictable things, right? In our district, wells are not predictable depths. You can hit water at 75 feet, or you might go down to 600 or 800 feet. You know, a well could cost anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. And so if you have a good well, you can share it with your neighbor, right? You can already do that. Two homes can share a well with no regulations. But as soon as you add a third one, you have to go to this Group B water system approval. And it's quite a process. In counties that choose to utilize the tools given to them in this bill, it will be much easier and cheaper to share this well with up to 9 homes. And it really is going to be good. And especially like my example at my house, I have a well and I'm sharing it with my brother-in-law who's building a house. And then I have another lot that I've considered letting my father-in-law build a house on. And I told my brother-in-law, you have to drill your own well when it's time to me to build a house on my other lot, because I don't want to have a Group B water system. Well, under this bill, I don't think I'm going to make him drill a well now.
Right.
I can share it with three. It's easy. So it's really going to streamline the process. And a lot of times it is families who are sharing these wells. It's not like developers are using Group Bs. It's right. mostly families.
Right. Interesting. All right. So those are the good bill. Were there some bad bills that some bills that you consider bad that got off the House floor?
Yeah, there were some tough ones. So just for context, what we're dealing with now are all the bills that the Senate had passed previously. They've now been sent over to the House. And there were a couple of big ones that we dealt with on Friday and Saturday. I kind of forget which were in which order just because of how long the days were. But we had some dealing with clergy as mandatory reporters. And I'll talk about that in a second. We also had unemployment insurance benefits for striking workers. The clergy's mandatory reporters bill is one that it has got kind of a long history here in the legislature. What that would do is it would take the existing state law that is silent about members of the clergy being mandatory reporters, in other words, being required to report under state law if there is reasonable basis to believe any sort of abuse of a child is taking place. And right now, you know, teachers and, you know, any number of different other categories of folks are mandatory reporters. And what this bill would do is it would make clergy mandatory reporters, but it would not have any sort of exception for what they call penitential communications like confession. So last session, this bill came forward and it had an exclusion, or rather an exemption, for things like confession. So if the clergy member found out about the alleged abuse in the course of confession, clergy member was not required to report it. Clergy member could if the clergy member chose to, but was not required to under state law. And that bill ultimately did not advance last session. Well, this session, but the bill actually had pretty significant bipartisan support last session. So this session, the bill sponsor said, you know what, we're not doing any exemptions. You just are a mandatory reporter. And that would actually make Washington an extreme outlier in the nation. There are only three or four other states that go that far, making clergy members mandatory reporters with no exceptions. And so we debated that for a very long time. We did offer an amendment to have an exemption for things like confession. The House denied that. Lots of very good discussion, debate about, you know, what the likely impact on this would be. And, you know, I argued that we can protect children and we must protect children. And we can also at the same time stand up for religious liberty. And I think that's what our proposed amendment would have done. Ultimately, unfortunately, after a long, long, long debate, the House did end up passing that off the floor, and we'll see where it goes from here. But that was a pretty significant debate toward the end of last week.
It really was. I think it's noteworthy that all the speeches, I believe, all or pretty much all the speeches on that debate on both sides of the political aisle wanted, I think, about the same thing, right? Everybody wants to protect kids from abuse. And it was a pretty passionate discussion. It really was about the religious liberty piece and the intent versus what's going to actually happen is a concern. But I just really want to make that point that the Democrats, they want this bill because they want to protect kids. Our argument was we don't believe this will protect kids. If you have offenders, or oftentimes it's the victims who may come to a confession and talk in a confidential way to a clergy, they might just not bring that up if they know this is a mandatory report situation. Mm-hmm. I know I've been a counselor for our church youth camp, and we'll have this discussion about the mandatory reporting thing, and it's encouraging to, if kids want to talk, that's great. If they start talking about anything that you might be a mandatory reporter on, it's encouraged typically to stop that discussion and inform them. And I just don't think that's helpful. You really want to encourage dialogue. And if you're in a situation that you're not a mandatory reporter, that does not preclude you from giving good advice to these people to encourage them to allow you to share it and to bring it out into the light. But the mandatory reporter law and infringement on religious liberty, we just don't believe it really will protect kids. And there's a disagreement on whether it will or not, but we all want the same thing, to protect kids.
Well, I think that's right. And my observation at the end of the debate is I thought the debate was pretty high quality, really. I think the strong points were made, both pro and con, and people voted how they were going to vote. But that being said, you know, this was difficult to discuss. Passions ran high. And, you know, at least one of the members on our side of the aisle made the point, he's upset. He's angry. You know, there was a chance for a bill with broad bipartisan support on an issue of deep personal importance to many people in the chamber. And the other side just didn't want to go down that route. They'd rather have one that's going to be, you know, party line, more or less. You know, it wasn't quite party line, but it was darn close.
Yeah.
And losing support of, you know, a significant portion of the chamber. And he just said, you know, I'm angry about that. You know, there was a better way to do this, and we chose not to do it.
One of our members was telling me he had talked with as a friend who's a Catholic priest, and had told him that there's been, I think, four times over the course of his time as a priest where he's had in the confessional of an abuser reported the abuse to him in the confessional, and the guy told him that all four times he's made a comment to the perpetrator that we need to have this conversation and have this move this conversation out of the confessional, and then immediately called the police. And so his belief was we don't need this exemption, that it's already often taken care of by the clergy who want to do the right thing typically find a way to do so.
And I don't want to lose the forest for the trees here. I mean, there are people who are in favor of this bill for, you know, a wide variety of reasons. Again, I think everybody's in favor of protecting children. You know, one of the concerns that I have is this does appear to be a broader attack on the Catholic Church in particular. And the point was made that these types of communications don't just take place in confession, which is a Catholic tradition. They take place in a variety of different religious beliefs and religious traditions, and that this bill would apply far broader than just the Catholic Church. But a big source of support for the bill appeared to me to be coming from those who have been attacking the Catholic Church for a long time. And that was a concern for me. The debate, I think, touched on that. And so, at any rate, as I said, I thought the debate went well. I was disappointed with the result. That was a pretty significant debate last week and a heavy lift.
Yeah, that we had a priest come in and talk on a different program that I host about this. It's really interesting how complex the whole process of confession is and absolution, all this stuff. He went into it pretty, and it was interesting because he had an understanding of where the bill sponsors were coming from as well. But the point he was trying to make is it's probably not going to make a big difference because, you know, I mean, a priest, I mean, basically, as one person said, it's God's law versus state law, right? And what's a priest supposed to do in a situation like that? So it puts them in a bad position for doing, you know, beyond just their job, but, you know, what they're, in their mind, what God has called them to do. And all of a sudden, by doing that, they'd be breaking the law in some instances, possibly.
Yeah, and that actually is directly one of the points that I made on the floor, is that this bill creates an irreconcilable conflict between the state's law and, in particular, if we are talking about the Catholic tradition, a priest and his vows to maintain the sanctity of the confessional seal. And a number of representatives on the floor pointed out, you know, history tells us what happens when there's a conflict between, you know, the church doctrine and man's law, and that is that, you know, more often than not, individuals will follow the church doctrine. It really ends up creating this difficult dynamic. And so, unfortunately, I think it's what we're doing here. I don't think it's going to have a real significant impact for the reasons we've already discussed, but it creates a very unhealthy dynamic. And at the bottom line, end of the day, I don't think it's going to help protect kids. That's really the problem here. I don't think it's going to end up protecting any children. So that was a concern that I have.
Let's talk a little bit about the unemployment insurance for striking workers and why that's something you oppose. This bill is now passed. I know there were amendments in the House, and if it's coming back to the Senate, should let people know how this process works once again. So, as Representative Abell mentioned, the bills that each chamber is voting on right now, our bills that already passed either the House or the Senate. But if there are changes made, amendments made to the bill, it has to head back to the Chamber of Origin. So For example, there was a rent control bill that passed the Senate floor. It had already passed the House, but there were amendments made in the Senate, so it's going back to the House. And we'll talk a little bit more about that here in just a bit. But so I guess with the unemployment insurance, this is a controversial bill. Were there changes made? Is that headed back to the Senate for?
There were.
Okay.
There were. So there was an amendment to limit the unemployment benefits for striking workers to 4 weeks, down from the 12 weeks in the bill that passed the Senate. And so that will be headed back to the Senate for concurrence vote. That was pretty controversial. I would say most of the Democrats voted against the amendment, but enough voted for it that it was adopted. And actually, the amendment came from a Democrat, so it probably feels kind of uncomfortable.
So the idea of this unemployment insurance bill, so people, for striking workers, right now, if you're on strike, you can't collect unemployment. The unions have basically a fund that helps these striking workers because they obviously aren't getting paid when they're on strike. But what this bill would do is would allow them to collect unemployment insurance while they're on strike. The original bill from the Senate, as Representative Engel mentioned, would have been for 12 weeks. As one person said, that pretty much guarantees the strike's going to last for 12 weeks. You know, I mean, so, you know, for people who are pro-labor, they say, yeah, this makes sense. But why, Representative Abel, does it not make sense to do this?
Well, it wouldn't make sense to do this for a variety of reasons. One, it does create very weird dynamics in a labor dispute where the dispute can be artificially prolonged, you know, as you pointed out, for kind of whatever the length might be for the you know, for the benefits. So that is a real concern. There was also concern by opponents or from opponents of the bill that really the bill lacked any sort of sensible guardrails in distinguishing between a strike that is about, you know, just the workers wanting more wages, kind of a traditional, you know, labor dispute over more wages, compared to a strike about unfair labor conditions or bad faith negotiating. And we actually offered an amendment that would differentiate between those two, where if you've got a strike where the workers want more money and the employer says we don't have it, that would be treated separately from a strike where you've got unfair or unsafe labor conditions or bad faith bargaining. That would be different. And so that was an effort to create some guardrails, to put some guardrails on this, and that effort was denied. I do want to take a step back, though. I do think that the amendment, which was adopted by the House to reduce the length of the benefits from 12 weeks down to 4 weeks, I think that is fascinating. So, you know, as you know, what typically happens is that the Democrats bring forward a bill, the Republicans offer some amendments, sometimes lots of amendments if it's a big bill, and the Democrats, you know, shout no when it comes time to vote, and the chair says the amendment is not adopted. Well, in this case, there was kind of a miniature rebellion within the Democrat caucus where some folks said, you know, we have to reduce the amount of benefits from 12 weeks down to 4 weeks. And so in that case, you know, that number of small, relatively small number of Democrats plus the entirety of the Republican caucus, for a very brief moment of time, were able to get something done on the floor. And when it came time for the speaker to, you know, say all those in favor of the amendment say yes, and all the Republicans and a couple of the Democrats shout yes, those opposed say nay, and the vast majority of the Democrats said nay or no, and the speaker said, the ayes have it, the amendment is adopted. So that was a rare brief moment of good news there on the floor. I wish the bill had not passed entirely because I think it is going to create bad dynamics. I think this bill lacks any sort of sensible guardrails, but 4 weeks is making a bad bill less bad.
Yeah, that's a big change, actually, from 12 to 4. So.
Yep. Well, it also is, you know, it's really shifting the cost of a strike from the workers having much skin in the game at all to almost all the cost of a strike being on the employer. Because these unemployment insurance benefits are paid by the employers, and some of it will be shifted to non-union employers as well.
Right. That's what it's not just the employer. It's really all employers and really employees, in a sense, that everyone who pays unemployment insurance, right? It gets shared. So it is, that is interesting, you know, that non-union shops may end up paying for strikes, mm-hmm. in a sense, for union shops.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah,
very good point.
I have a question from a listener. Would like to know if there are any plans in lowering the senior discount for fishing and hunting licenses, which is currently at age 70.
To lower the age?
Yeah.
Or the, you know, not that I'm aware of. It's a good question. Most of the proposals we have seen here in Olympia have been to increase the fees associated with pretty much everything, including hunting and fishing licenses. And so a proposal like this to lower the age for a discount, I'm not aware of it. Andrew, have you heard of anything like that?
I have not heard of that yet. And the hunting fishing license bill has not come up for a vote yet. So it hasn't even made it out of the rules committee, which means it's not on the list yet. So it's something, though, that we could look at an amendment to it to reduce the age to maybe 65 or...
Well, I'm 45. Can we do that?
Yeah. 45. Maybe we could reduce the age to, like, 16.
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
Get it with hunter safety.
I mean, I oppose this huge increase in hunting and fishing licenses. I think that's a concern. The other thing that's also related here is the Discover Pass, 50% increase to Discover Pass, and that one is on the list now. We expect to debate that soon. And I came up with a couple of amendments for that. I actually have a problem with the fundamental principles behind the Discover Pass. This came in, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago as a way to try to fund infrastructure on public lands.
Yeah, I think it was during a time where they were trying to they wanted a no new tax budget, so they decided to raise some fees instead and create some new ones, and this
yes.
was one of them.
Well, and the problem is it's excluded a lot of people from public lands, and I just believe that if we're going to have all this public land in our district, which a lot of it is in our district, that the public should have access to it and shouldn't have to have pay a fee to go use it. And so I've had problems with this from the beginning, and there's firsthand experience where, as I was a kid growing up, we would go to these state lands a lot as a cheap or actually free, other than paying the gas that used to be cheap to get there, and we'd enjoy these lands. And I believe children that grow up in nature become better citizens. They have a grounding in the real natural world, and it's really a value. But what I've seen is with the Discover Pass, a lot of people in our district no longer go to these state lands, and especially families, these children are denied access. So I have a fundamental problem with that. I also have a real pet peeve with the fact that we're required to have a Discover Pass to go on state lands that have no infrastructure, right? There's no restrooms, there's no parking lots, but it's a dirt road that goes up into the woods, and if you want to go huckleberry picking, you have to have a Discover Pass to drive on these logging roads that are really paid to be maintained by the timber harvest on those lands. So I have two amendments that I came up with. One is to eliminate the requirement to have a Discover Pass on undeveloped state lands. So you'd still have to have it to go to a park with restrooms and fishing docks and things like that. But you would no longer have to have it to go out on forest roads. The other one is we have a National Park Pass exemption for fourth graders, and it's called the Every Kid Outdoors Program. And so if the year that a child's in fourth grade, them and their family can have a free National Parks Pass. And so I'm working to create a similar system in Washington State for the Discover Pass, where at least one time in a child's life, their family can have free access to state lands through getting a free Discover Pass in the year they're in fourth grade. So I've introduced both of those amendments. I know I've talked to at least one Democrat who said he'll support them, and we'll see how it goes.
Does he have a kid in fourth grade?
You know, he doesn't, but I think that's a good question.
There might be a ready source of support for
I
you.
Do have a kid in fourth grade.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Well, Tracy, just really quickly on the question from the listener about, you know, potentially reducing the age. I think it's an interesting idea, you know, and, I think we want to take steps to improve and strengthen our tradition of hunting and fishing, you know, here in the state of Washington. One of the things that I've discovered since I arrived here in the legislature is we've got these informal groups that meet that are called caucuses. We've got the formal groups that meet, the formal caucuses that meet, the Republican caucus and the Democrat caucus. We've also got the Veterans Caucus and the Nuclear Energy Caucus. Well, there's also a Sportsman's Caucus. And they are dedicated to improving and strengthening and defending our hunting and fishing rights here in the state. So I think that would be a good group for us to potentially reach out to get some more information on this idea. So thank you to the listener.
It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short, who's not here today, but I thought I'd mention normally with Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell, who are both here on Okanagan Country Radio. And that was a great question. We invite you to ask your questions by emailing me directly, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov, tracy@leg.wa.gov, or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative State Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. You can, again, email me if you have questions, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov, tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov, or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. And actually, we do have a question from a listener that just came in, and Andrea says, back years ago, the Discover Pass, lands were supported by taxes that we pay. Now we have to buy a pass, but we still pay the taxes. So why do we need to buy a pass? What happened to the money we've already been paying? So I guess...
Well, I can jump on this. The problem is that they want to spend a whole lot more money than they bring in. So they... The majority party here seems to have an insatiable desire to spend money. So the part of what's happened is they've had the Discover Pass, and then they've actually shifted some of the funds from the general fund away. So those funds no longer go to this. They're actually getting excited about a potential windfall from this 50% increase in fees. I know I met with the parks director, and they're kind of all scrambling over what are they going to do with all this money. I will not be surprised if it doesn't actually bring in as much money as they think, because it's not going to bring in 50% more money, because a lot of people are just not going to buy it anymore. And so that's a problem. But I would agree with the listener that parks should not be funded entirely by user fees. There's a benefit to the public for this. And I see some, you know, philosophically, user fees make sense, that the people who use them should be the ones paying for them. But the problem is it becomes an elitist thing. We have a huge state budget. We have state lands that should be available to everyone. And so, well, I don't have a problem with, like, camping fees, boat launch fees, things like that, that there's a specific amount of money going into something that the majority of the public does not get benefit from. You should pay for that. But generally on parks, I think we should be funding it other ways.
Well, and just, you know, riffing off of Andrew's comment earlier about having a philosophical problem with the Discover Pass, I think it's a little bit misleading to describe the lands that we're talking about as state lands. I think it's more accurate to describe them as the taxpayers' lands. It's the people's lands,
yeah.
Right? And so this idea that you have to have a pass to go out and, you know, breathe the air that is on these lands, or look at these lands, or be on these lands, is really problematic. I don't think the program is very well, or rather, I don't think that the money that's derived from the program is very well spent. So that's a separate problem. But even going back to the basics, I have a problem with the philosophical concept of requiring a pass to go out and be on your state lands. It's your property, and that's a concern that I have.
Yep.
Soon as you talk about the money, I guess maybe it's a good chance for us to talk a little bit about the budget, because I was surprised to hear this. The other day I was hosting a podcast, and Representative Chris Corey was on, and he said, using appropriations, he said, it seems like there's still like an 8% increase in spending, even though there's talk about, you know, raising taxes and this deficit. Generally, when you're talking about filling a hole in a budget, the first thing you do is you stop the bleeding, right? Mm-hmm. You stop digging the hole, yeah. right? So you don't spend additional money. That's just kind of basic budgeting. But I did not realize, I guess, that there's still that majority of Democrats are still talking about increasing spending, even with this budget shortfall. You're on appropriation, or you're on finance.
I'm on finance, that's right. Yep.
But, you know, so you have to pay for it.
Yeah. So, well, you all have to pay for
right.
it.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that true? Is the budget, I mean, that's one of the, I think that's one of the issues that Governor Ferguson has as well, right, with this budget.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Tracy. So I think it's really interesting that the Democrats, majority of Democrats, have put together this budget proposal, which marries increasing a whole series of taxes, B&O taxes, a proposed wealth tax, increase in the gas tax, increase in property tax, with really sizable increased spending. And the reason I think that dynamic is so interesting is our governor has said that we can't keep doing business the same way we've been doing business, you know, before here in Olympia. He said we need to have, I believe his exact quote was, we need to have an honest conversation about how we got to this point. And the Democrats in the House and the Senate seem to have largely kind of nodded politely and then did exactly the same. And that's really a problem. And so, you know, I'm curious to see what the governor's response is going to be. He has already said that he's not going to sign a budget that includes the legally very questionable so-called wealth tax. And so that appears to be kind of off in its own category. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with regard to the other proposed tax increases and the increased spending. But we are in rubber meets the road territory now in this budget. We're going to find out a lot more in the next, you know, 2 weeks about what this budget is going to look like. The Democrats have largely, you know, committed themselves to significant increased spending and significant increased taxes. How much both of those are going to be is still up in the air. And really what the governor's position is going to be on both of those remains yet to be seen. He did give himself some kind of wiggle room at his last press conference, which some people pointed out was on April Fool's Day. So we'll see if we're all told it's just April right. Fool's the next 2 weeks. But I think to the governor's point that we need to have an honest conversation about how we got to this point. Republicans have been pounding on the table about that for some time. So that was at least welcome to hear.
It's interesting because I think I've heard, so if it just, if we were to continue spending exactly as it is today without cutting anything, you know, you might be looking at a $7 billion around there mm-hmm. shortfall. So, you know, obviously Republicans are not supportive of new taxes or anything, but say you just had new taxes to pay for this shortfall, right? That's $7 billion. There's a $21 billion tax package on the table. You know, that's $14 billion more.
Well, and part of my theory here is what we're seeing is the old line, I think it was from Congressman Rahm Emanuel, who said, never let a crisis go to waste.
Right, right.
And it's been attributed to a lot of people.
Right,
so
right.
I think there are some folks in the Democrat majority side who said, oh, we've got a crisis. Oh, boy, you know, the house is on fire. Let's go ahead and really, go crazy in raising taxes, you know, far beyond what some would say we need in order to address the deficit. And that doesn't, you know, again, even look at finding efficiencies within the existing budget mm-hmm. To try and address that. So I think there is a little bit of that. Just speaking candidly, I think there's an idea that among some that there's an opportunity here to really raise taxes and spend money in ways that I think a lot of people would certainly on this side of the aisle disagree with, but the folks on the other side of the aisle very much agree with.
What are your thoughts on the budgeting process? So essentially what ended up happening is both the House and Senate passed a budget, and now the Democrats, I guess there are Republicans invited, but there's going to be closed-door negotiations and then they're probably near the end of session, a final budget will just appear, right, that they agree to in these, you know, back offices here in the state capitol. What's your thought on that? the process?
Well, Senator Short talked about this, I think, last week, that the Senate Republicans offered a legislative vehicle which would have had this process take place in public, and let the public see the negotiations and the final budget product take place. Well, the majority of Democrats didn't want that. They said, no, we like the public, we trust the public, just not that much. We don't want them to see, you know, us hammer out this budget document amongst ourselves and with the House leadership. So that did not end up going anywhere. I think one thing that strikes me about this is that as much as the public is in the dark, in some ways, actually, Andrew and I are in the dark as well. Yeah. Neither of us serve on the respective committee. Neither of us would be in the reconciliation process. We're not going to be in the room where it happens. Instead, we're going to largely see the budget, you know, kind of around the same time as when other folks here in the Capitol, in the legislature, see the budget.
It's huge.
It's huge, right.
Read the whole thing and then vote on it, right? It's
like, there is a slight wrinkle because I serve on finance, is that depending on how much they decide to raise the spending, it's going to be, you know, my committee that will be having a spirited debate on the tax policy in order to fund it. So I'm assuming the Democrats are going to be doing pedal to the metal, for a lot of taxes, and Republicans are going to be trying to slam on the brake and say, no, this is a terrible idea. So that is still going to happen in finance. But, you know, the budget process, this is our first session being here, so we're seeing it play out in real time. But my understanding is that we're going to largely see it around the same time that other folks here in the Capitol see it. Do you have any thoughts, Andrew?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think it's we'll hear about it probably the same time as the general public.
Mm-hmm.
The tax that sometimes I feel like it, everybody can agree on that they don't like seeing it go up is the property tax. And there's a rally on the Capitol, here at the Capitol, scheduled for tomorrow on that. There was the Senate Republicans held a big press conference on it last week as well. And there seems to be a lot of opposition to this proposed property tax increase. In the Senate, the proposal is to allow, so basically it's property tax hike increases. So how much the property tax can go up every year. The proposal of the Senate is to allow that to go up with inflation and population growth. The proposal of the House is to allow it to go up 3% a year. It's currently capped at 1%. Are you hearing from constituents on this potential for property taxes to increase?
Boy, my email inbox is melting down over this and has been for a while. People are really fired up about it, and I think rightly so for a couple of reasons. This will impact people on limited incomes the most, so our retirees who are rightly concerned about being taxed out of their homes. I'm also hearing real concern from folks who say, look, you know, all session long we've been talking about how we're in this housing crisis, and the first thing you all want to do is increase, you know, property taxes, which is only going to make home ownership more expensive and more inaccessible for a lot of people. So yeah, I've been hearing a tremendous amount about this.
Yeah, and same here. It's a lot. And I'll hear from some of the local governments that would like the authority to raise property taxes without going to a vote of the people. Obviously, governments, people who spend other people's money would always like to spend more of it. And genuinely, there is a lot of cost, right? Costs go up for local governments just as they go up for everyone else. And so they see it as costs are going up faster than the 1% per year that they're allowed to raise the taxes without a vote of the people. I make the case to them that they need to put it to a vote. These local governments have the ability to raise taxes faster, but they have to let their people vote on it in order to do so, and that's what they need to do.
And we should note, too, that new construction isn't included in the cap. So while there is a 1% cap, property tax increases are higher than 1% because new construction isn't included in that. So,
right, first year.
So they've basically been, if you look at it, it looks like basically, it's been keeping up with inflation anyway, you know, the increase.
Well, some places it is and some places it isn't.
Right.
A lot of the 7th District is growing pretty slow. So I think genuinely on their argument, a lot of the 7th District is not growing enough. So they're not keeping up with inflation.
Okay.
So that is a concern, but mostly they're figuring out how to deal with this. They're pretty far behind in a lot of ways.
it also makes a strong case against some of these unfunded mandates the state's trying to put on when they could only raise the levy by 1% per year. We can't add more than 1% more mandates, right?
Yeah, I was
so
thinking
it gives us ammo
legislators
to fight back against putting more requirements on our counties and cities. And so if this goes in, it's also, I think, noteworthy that if this is adopted, it applies to the state portion of taxes as well. Most of the property taxes we're paying are going to the state. And so if we have the ability to raise taxes 3% instead of 1%, well, you can pretty much guarantee the state's going to raise them 3% every year. The county and the cities, they're going to have to make this calculation politically with, do their people want them to take this 3%? They might not get the benefit. So it maybe your taxes go up, but your local city may not benefit.
And really just kind of hammering home that point, you know, one thing that has struck me time after time after time that I've been here at Olympia is just the insatiable appetite for Olympia, for the state government to increase the tax money that it has and the power that it wants to have. And I kind of knew that coming in. I talked about that during the campaign, but seeing it, you know, play out in real time here on these types of debates is really striking. And I think that's an important dynamic here in the property tax debate. A big part of it is the state government wanting to grow itself.
Well, here's a double whammy that if rent control, it looks like the rent control bill, who knows what's going to happen. So basically what's happened with rent control is that it passed the House a 7% cap on rent increases, came over to the Senate, they amended it to a 10% plus inflation cap. But, I mean, a landlord may be hit with this rent control and at the same time a property tax increase. It's a double whammy, right? I mean, you're a landlord, you know, representative Engel, so
it is. It absolutely is, and there's other costs too, right?
For
homeowners as well as landlords, costs are going up faster than inflation. It's property taxes, insurance is a concern, especially in our district where the risk of wildfire is there. The wildfire insurance is sometimes 40, 50, 100% increases in insurance. So there's a lot of expenses. So it's all these things will work together to make housing more unaffordable.
You wanted to talk about the situation in Pennsylvania with the governor, Representative Bell. I know. Why is that something you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, thanks, Tracy, for giving me a chance to talk about this. So for listeners who may be unaware, there's some news over the last 24 hours that there was an attack in Harrisburg, in the state capital there in Pennsylvania, where the governor's mansion, where Governor Shapiro and his family live, was attacked overnight. There was an individual broke in and set off some sort of incendiary device that did tremendous damage. The state patrol officers on guard there at the house pounded on the door, woke up the family, and got them out just fine. So none of the family members were injured. Significant damage to the house, and a scary moment for all involved. And I wanted to talk about that because, one, just, you know, obviously, you know, I'm very prayerfully thankful that nobody in the family was injured or hurt in that attack. But then, two, just to talk about, you know, this kind of unusual dynamic, this time that we live in, where some people seem willing to take, you know, engage in violent actions against political opponents. And there's, again, still a lot we don't know about this particular incident, but, you know, extremely disconcerting, you know, completely condemn it in the strongest possible language and terms. And one thing that has struck me about my limited time here in Olympia is that as much as I may agree or disagree with other folks, you know, either in the governor's office or in the state Supreme Court or here in the Capitol building, is that it is a small community. These are people, and an attack on, you know, a place like the governor's mansion is really hits home, I'm sure, for that entire Capitol community. And also, it's their home. It's where they live. Somebody tried to burn down their home with them in it. It's really shocking.
I'm seeing some of the pictures now online. It's significant damage.
Massive damage.
Yeah,
massive damage. I mean, it makes me think if it happened here in Olympia, there would be, you know, people extremely concerned. And the fact that it happens to take place, you know, on the East Coast, we're a little bit geographically removed, but it does still strike home, I think, for every Capitol community.
I think maybe it is good. Everyone's talking about, and you hear this, this is something you hear from, I mean, all legislators, really, that, you know, violence has no place in the political realm, right? I mean, I'm sure you both feel that way.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, It is. It's too bad. And, you know, we've had here in at the state capitol, I don't think I've ever seen any, you know, violence. But, you know, there have been times where people have come and protested at the governor's mansion or at the capitol, and it can get tense. But, you know, this is just a whole other level.
Right. You know? And there does appear to be some, you know, initial reports that indicate that, you know, this was an attempted assassination of the governor. You know, and so I always take these kind of initial reports a bit with a grain of salt. We'll see what it looks like, you know, a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, when there's an investigation, and, you know, see if there's a trial and what that ends up resulting in. But, you know, bottom line here today, you know, what we know is that somebody tried to burn down the house with, you know, the governor's family in it. And that's extremely concerning. Should be of concern for all of us, I believe.
So coming up this week, we have another deadline. We call them cutoffs here, and this is the cutoff for bills that came over, for the Senate bills that came over from the House, and for the House bills that came over from the Senate have to be voted on by the end of the day, Tuesday, so tomorrow is that cutoff. And then you may be asking yourself, well, what happens then? Well, first off, all the budget bills are still in play. So anything that has to do with the budget, those aren't subject to the cutoff. Secondly, any changes that were made, I mentioned this earlier, if a change was made to a bill from the House and the Senate or vice versa, those bills have to come back, and either the opposite chamber has to agree to it, or there is what's called a conference, and where the two sides get together, representatives from both the House and Senate, and try to work out a compromise that the chambers can vote on. So that's the process now. Are there any bills on the horizon that you're on the lookout for?
Well, one, it's the domestic workers bill is something that I think, I get the gut feeling that the purpose of the bill is to try to protect illegal immigrants who are working as house workers and gardeners and lawn mowers. My concern is that it puts a lot of new regulations on that industry, and it makes the people who employ even services of independent contractors employers. And it's complicated, but my major concern is that it's going to impact a lot of people in our district who are typically not immigrants, where it's oftentimes young people who will go and be entrepreneurial, and they'll want to start mowing lawns or cleaning houses as a business, and they're independent contractors. So I've got an amendment to narrow that down so that independent contractors who have a small business license would be exempt from the requirements. And also those who, which I think I gave this one, I wrote a few amendments and I passed them out to other people to try to protect those small businesses that are so common in rural Washington, because my concern is that it's going to result in more of this consolidation. It's going to push them into bigger companies who are hiring these and getting rid of the entrepreneurial spirit that's so common in Northeast Washington. So that's a concerning bill. There's a whole bunch of concerning bills. Hunter, is there any on top of your mind?
There's another one. It's a bit of a sequel in a way to one we saw earlier, and that's the Parents' Bill of Rights bill again. And the reason for that is because the Senate passed it with some changes, and so it's going to come back to the House, and so we'll be addressing that. And that could be significant.
What's odd about that issue, there's also a Senate bill. There are two bills related to parents' bills, mm-hmm. Bill of Rights. One that came from the Senate, one that came from the House. So I think you're taking up the Senate bill.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I misspoke. We're taking up the Senate version, correct. So the Senate version is coming over.
It might be today. Yeah. We're supposed to be on the floor, which we need to get
in
out of
about
here.
2 minutes.
We're supposed to be on the floor in 4 minutes.
Yeah.
That's across campus. But, the rumor is that that's going to be, we'll have the opening ceremony, opening prayer, mm-hmm. Pledge of Allegiance, and then we may go straight into debating this Parents' mm-hmm. Bill of Rights today. We'll see.
So, you know, there are two of those bills, more complex than we have time for right now. And next week, we'll cover, I'm sure, what these Parents' Bill of Rights bills do and what actually was approved. Just about a minute left. I know you had some people visit the campus like you said last week, and I know that's always invigorating for you. You know, again, we invite people to come here.
Yeah.
You know, if you get a chance, come over to Olympia, say hi.
We love to have visitors. You know, I was over here at the Capitol yesterday because my family went home, and so I went to church, and then I came over here and was doing some work in the office, and I really like visitors. We don't have any of my own, so I just honestly wandered around the Capitol, looked for people, and I'd ask where they're from and ask if they wanted to see the floor, and I'd take them out and give them some little tours.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, that's cool.
Visitors are fantastic, and we had that. I believe it was the Log Cabin Christian School from Brewster.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Okanagan County. Some of our listeners might be familiar with that group. It was their fourth grade class came. That's the one that joined us for the bill signing with the governor, and that was delightful. Anytime anybody from the district's coming over, please let us know, because we'd love to try to make your visit special. And with that, we better get to the floor.
Yeah, I think we got to run.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for doing this. Really appreciate it. Those were Representatives Hunter A. Bell and Andrew Engel. Senator Short wasn't able to make it today. Hopefully we'll get her back with us next week, and it will be next week at same time, 8 o'clock, for Live from Olympia with the 7th Legislative District legislators, like I said, typically Senator Short, and also Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell. By the way, if you ever want to check out their website, it's really easy. It's SenatorShellyShort.com, RepresentativeAndrewEngel.com, and RepresentativeHunterABell.com. I'm Trace Yellis with the Senate Republican Caucus, and we hope you have a great day. Thank you so much for joining us on this Monday morning.